they pale into insignificance in terms of places in my heart compared to this, because it's history, it's his story. You know, it's the story of Christ.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Welcome to The Profile, brought to you by Premier Christianity Magazine. I'm Sam Hales, and I'm delighted to say that my guest today is the adventurer, survivalist, and TV star Bear Grylls. Bear is the author of a number of books, and his most recent one is called The Greatest Story Ever Told, and it is a thriller about the life of Jesus. We're going to talk about the book and lots more. Bear, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you. Yeah.
Now, I know you're not a stranger to Premier, you were telling me. You have a connection to Premier Christian Radio already. What is that?
Well, my mum is probably Premier Christian Radio's greatest fan. And I do, there's certain things I do in my life because of my mum. Today is definitely one of them. And we love you guys and you do a great job. But mum is always a driving force. She's always going, you've got to do something on Premier Christian Radio. You've got to do more with them. And actually, the more, you know, following you guys over the years, you do such a great job across so many different mediums, your podcast, your magazine, and the radio. And, you know, and hearing that you're a charity, and I don't know, you're a powerhouse as a sort of collective group. You're a powerhouse for good. You know, you share light, love, and all the good stuff. So mum is very pleased I'm doing this.
Amazing.
The other thing I did for her was that BBC show, Who Do You Think You Are, a few years ago. My wife kept saying, you've got to, and they'd asked a few times, and it's kind of, it'd never been quite the right time. And Shara's going, you've got to do it before your mum is no longer with us. And so I've done that, and now Premier Christian Radio.
There you go.
And not that we want mum to go anywhere, but one day she will die a happy lady.
It's important.
And she'll be listening to this, and mum, if you're listening to this, love you very much. What a great lady you are. What a great example you are, mum, to so many people in your community that love you. You do so much for so many people, from running Alpha courses to helping people and raising money for Admiral Nurses. And so my mum is a great inspiration.
What a lovely place to start, showing love and tribute to mum. I love that. We're here to talk about many things. One of them is your latest book, which I mentioned at the beginning, The Greatest Story Ever Told. Now, you've written 100 books, but this one is special, isn't it? What is so special about this book?
Because it's his, ultimately. You know, it's the first book. I mean, I've written, as you say, a bunch of books over the years on many different things, of expeditions and, you know, and autobiography stuff, and then a lot of survival stuff, and then a lot of kids' books, and a lot of kind of manual type things of how to, you know, everything from tie knots, making camps, to, you know, all sorts of books over the years. And I'm proud of them. I am proud of them. I don't want to belittle them. You know, they've had heart and soul in them, and, you know, sharing sort of good life stuff. But this is different. You know, and this trumps them all, not by a small margin, by a long way. And as I said, when we were together at Spring Harvest, you know, I would give up everything to have done. In my work world, I would give up everything I've done. Every Everest summit, every Emmy, every all of these sort of things. They pale into insignificance in terms of places in my heart compared to this, because it's history, it's his story. You know, it's the story of Christ written in a way that is accessible. And I think, you know, so many people of faith, and myself included, you know, how often have people read actually the whole, like, Bible, or even just the New Testament, or even just the four Gospels? You know, the vast majority of us know stories. We know, like, the Good Samaritan, or, you know, the crucifixion or whatever. But I wanted to write the whole story as in a really sort of, as you say, as a thriller. But I didn't want to change a single word of Jesus's, you know, and I think that's been the difference here, and it's been the challenge as well. But yeah, it's the proudest thing in my work world I've ever done. If I could only be remembered for one thing, this would be it. And it's the one that I have the greatest hope and ambition for, and putting the most sort of time, love, and energy into. And like I say, I actually do many of these sort of things. I do it because I really want people to experience this story. Because, yeah, as with you, Sam, and as with me and so many people we know and love, the story changes us.
I'd love to hear a bit more about that. You know, why is the story of Jesus the greatest story ever told, and how does it change you? You know, for someone who doesn't understand what that means, this is a story that happened 2,000 years ago. What's the relevance for me today?
Well, the great thing about this book is it doesn't need selling. You know, it will sell itself when people read it, and I've had it already. Just I'm getting things every day already, and it's not even out. You know, I had it from the chairman of one of the biggest companies in the world, one of the biggest drinks company in the world. I won't say which, but the chairman of it, you know, multi-billionaire US guy, you know, he texts me almost every day going, what is happening to me as I'm reading this book? I'm crying every day. My wife doesn't know what's happening. She goes, what is in this book? And he goes, I've had a faith all my life, but this is like, it's telling it in a way I've never experienced before. And the Holy Spirit's touching me. And that's a beautiful kind of thing to hear. But I don't know. I think ultimately it's all of our stories wrapped up in this story. You know, whether we're the skeptic, whether we're the proud one, whether we're the nervous one, whether we're the broken one, you know, it's all of our stories are wrapped up in, because it's the way Jesus worked, you know, and the people he met and the way he interacted with everyone from the elite to the lowest, most broken, you know, prostitute. You know, he never interacted with anyone where they didn't leave changed. And as a reader, it feels a little like this. And I write the book from five different perspectives. First of all, for Mary. The book starts off innocent as a young, very nervous, you know, teenager, pregnant, out of wedlock. And her story starts innocent, nervous, excited. And then it goes to Thomas, who's very skeptical from the beginning of everything that he's starting to see with Jesus, but he tags along because he's not quite sure why. And then it goes to Peter, who's like all in, like heart, like a wild one. And there goes to John, and then it ends with Mary Magdalene, who that encounter with Jesus were at a stage where she was really broken in life, you know, and she became one of his closest followers, and she takes us through the end of the crucifixion and resurrection. And so I don't know, it's kind of all of our stories wrapped up in one, and whoever you are, I think you'll relate to it, and that's the fun part for me. And the other fun part is it hasn't even begun yet. I know this book is going to have an effect like nothing I've ever done in my work world. You know, you do TV shows and people enjoy it and hopefully, you know, and have a good time, enjoy watching something for an hour. But this is different. This gets in people's hearts and doesn't let them go. And it's hard to kind of finish it unchanged and for the better. Yeah. So I'm excited for it because it's just beginning. I can feel it. I'm getting these letters, these emails, these texts from people of all sorts of people. But it still hasn't really begun. Okay. And that's kind of exciting too.
Very exciting. So let's go back to the beginning.
By the way, for that kind review.
Oh, you're welcome. Really,
that was so sweet to see. And you know, that's one of the first reviews of it. So it's nice to start off on the
front
foot.
We like to get in there quick at Premier Christianity Magazine and review stuff. And yeah, our reviewer loved it. So well done on that. I have to say, 5-star reviews are genuinely quite rare in the mag. Our reviewers have high standards. So it was great to see.
Well, it's like you got to get it right. That's the other thing, is like you can't kind of get this wrong. And, you know, one of the last books I read was by John Eldridge, who wrote a beautiful, beautiful book. And it's like, you know, it's this 300-page book on most of it, just on the interaction of Jesus with Peter at the Lake Galilee after the resurrection. And it's like the sort of intonations and the nuances of every interaction. And, you know, I could quote 100 books on every interaction that through the New Testament. It's like, therefore, you've got to get it right. And it took a long time to really get it right, because there's so many little bits. You're like, hold on, can't throw that away. But you've got to keep it so tight as well. And
it's that balance between you are a bit like people who have seen The Chosen. You're reimagining these kind of backstories to some of these characters, but you're trying to do it in a way that's biblically faithful, that's not directly contradicting the text,
yeah,
but is bringing something in. I mean, was that kind of fun to, I think, of the moment of the resurrection, and you kind of imagine the women going to the tomb and expecting to smell the stench of death, and they don't. Mm. And that almost being the first thing that tips them off to something isn't quite right here. Mm. You know, imagining those moments, they're not directly in scripture, but they're very plausible. That is exactly how the women might have felt as they entered the tomb.
I think it's more than that. You know, I think The Chosen does a great job, but they are ultimately creating scenes that didn't happen and creating dialogue that Jesus didn't say. But that holds still a beautiful place in people's journey of faith, because The Chosen just keeps nudging people towards the light, and it does it brilliantly. But I definitely wanted to be, I really want to be absolutely faithful to, there are no scenes in this that are imagined. You know, they're feelings and some dialogue between other people, but there's no dialogue from Jesus that's made up. Not a single word. I haven't changed not even a comma from the New Testament. I've used different versions, you know, and there are no scenes that are made up. There's just feelings of people's, what they probably would have 99% felt in that, which is going to be terror or awe or excitement or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was a dramatization, but very accurate and factual. And that's why I couldn't do this on my own. I work with a lot of different theologians. In fact, we work with a lot of The Chosen theologians who were incredible and really helped me draft after draft, tighten, mm-hmm. correct, nudge.
How long did it take to write?
Well, I wrote it in the jungle when I was filming Bear Hunt, our Netflix show. I had my son out with me. We were staying in this little jungle lodge. And I would write all night. And he was like, we were sharing a room together. And he said, "What, Dad, what, are you okay? Are you like on something? You know, it's like you're not sleepy. You just write. I leave you at 11 o'clock and I come in at 4 because we're getting up because we're filming early. And you're still there and go, oh, you know. But it's like it just came. Really, I've never had that experience before. I don't want to kind of over-egg it. It was like literally like that. I've you know, asked him. It was like an incredible experience. Wow. But then after I'd written it, it was like the torturous bit. It was like back over and over and the arguing and between all the the nuances of this and that. But we'd just filmed this series with The Chosen called Chosen in the Wild, where I got to take 6 of the cast members out on Running Wilds, essentially. And that show comes out early next year, ready as a lead-in for their season 6 of The Chosen. So the kind of timing and serendipity was interesting. But I lent on a lot of those theologians, having sort of, you know, met those teams to help. And Andrew Ollerton was more than that. He was like an absolute guide, steer, brother, confident, mentor, and truly incredible. Mm. And actually the real unsung hero behind the greater story, because his knowledge is amazing. And he said a really beautiful thing. He said, "I've sometimes wondered why I've been led all my life into such depth of academic, theological study. You know, book after book, library after library, PhD after PhD." And he goes, "Part of it has been for this, you know, it's like I've needed this knowledge. We've gone so deep and it might only be a line in here." Mm. But like John Eldridge will read the encounter with Peter at the end and he'll go, "You've got it." But a casual reader wouldn't even notice, won't know, you know, so that's why it took so long.
Yeah. It's good to hear the process that's gone into it. I want to go back to the beginning. We like to hear about people's early life growing up here on the show. So we've already mentioned your mum. Tell me more about your family, your background. I mean, did the Christian faith come into the picture early on in life, or was that something that came later for you?
I don't know. I think faith was there early on. You know, as a really small kid, I just remember I'd always be outside. Always be, you know, scantily clad, running around bare feet, sort of, you know, nature felt natural. I was always like, I loved adventure. I loved climbing with my dad. I loved swimming in the sea. I was brought up in the Isle of Wight. My mum still lives there. You know, time back from school, we'd just, you know, even in the winter, we'd just like swim and we'd climb and we were outdoors. And it was like, faith was wrapped up in all of that. It really was. I look back now and I wouldn't articulate it when I was a kid like that, but it's how it was. It was like I knew there was something out there beyond me. You know, there was something amazing out there. I could feel it. You know, I kind of lived like that. And I think, you know, my parents weren't churchy at all. You know, that definitely wasn't part of life. My grandfather had a really beautiful faith. And he lived with us in the final years of his life. And actually, I really remember him always kneeling beside his bed. And I think that, and he was such a beautiful, strong man, you know, played cricket for England, 6'6", super good looking, voted the best looking man at Oxford University in 1920 or whatever he was there, you know, like just a beautiful, gentle, humble guy. And yet he would kneel and say his prayers. And that always struck me. And it was simple. His prayer was always really simple. But beyond that, I didn't really have a church growing up. Then I went to school and boarding school, and that was very churchy, chapel, religious. And I just kind of instantly thought, I've got it wrong. You know, I just got it wrong.
You know, didn't connect with you in that way.
No, it was the opposite. It was like, I have faith wrong. God is not everywhere and in us and amazing, and you know, God is in cassocks and speaks Latin, drones on for too long in sermons. The language of all the things is so I don't know what you're talking about, and I've got it wrong. So I let kind of faith go, even though I just kind of thought that doesn't apply for my life. And I think the rest of my life has been an untangling of that, to realize actually that little boy had it right. Little boy had it right. Faith is in your heart. Faith is beautiful. Faith is strong and empowering and light and love and hard to articulate and freedom and in connection with others. And, you know, that, and you can't pin it down. It's not in a church, you know, and it's that great cartoon a little old lady and St. Paul's Cathedral. And one says church, arrow to her. The other says arrow, building. You know, church is here, you know, helping the little old lady or in our kids or your relationships or our conversations. You know, the intangibles, mm-hmm. not a building. And so it's been an untangling of that. But I suppose I came back to it as a teenager at a moment when my godfather, who was, I was really close to, who's my dad's best friend, such a huge part of our life growing up, was always staying with us. You know, it's just a huge figure, died out of the blue. And I just remember age about 15, up a tree, distraught, just wanted to get away. Went to this tree. I always used to love being up down the end of the garden and just crying. You know, you know, I didn't cry as a teenager. You know, it's like you're in survival mode as a teenager. and I just let it go and I cried. And I just remember saying a prayer saying, I wish, God, you were real. I wish you were like I knew you when I was a boy. Are you there? You know, and it didn't have an amen or anything. It was just a heart cry of like, and it's the, you know, it's a prayer of salvation, isn't it? Which is like, be with me on the journey. Be with me. I'm going to have doubts and I'm not going to be certain of things, but be with me. And as I say, the rest of life has been an up and down journey of still many doubts and struggles. But that burner got turned up, that pilot light that's in us all. That moment, you know, something happened. It was nothing kind of like dramatic on it, but like I look back now and then something happened then, and people came into my life that became great mentors, guides, friends, faith sort of, you know, brothers, and the journey began.
Yeah, and I suppose people won't be surprised to hear that wonderful story of you as a young boy outside in nature. I find that so interesting that even at a young age you were, and you're right, faith is hard to articulate, but there was something of being out and about in the wild, in nature, you describe running barefoot, and some connection to God in that. Mm. And has that continued for you? You know,
that's why when I say it's been an unwinding, it's been an untangling, it's getting back to that. You know, more and more so I live like that now, you know, with my family, keep it simple. You know, we don't do a lot of the flash stuff, to be honest. If I go and film and I come back and we're at home, and, you know, I just came back yesterday from North Wales where we have this place, and we were up there, Shara and me, and our 21-year-old was with us. And he said it. He goes, you know what, this place has been just such a, I never realised it growing up, but, you know, it's just simple outdoors, you know, part of our life. And so much of my work is like that, you know, we're in jungles, deserts, mountains. I think early on in my career, it was always a battle. Those places always a battle. Now I realise actually it's coming full circle.
How were they a battle?
I don't know. It's like, get in, this is hell, work hard, it's going to beat the hell out of you, have your guard up, fight. You know, and there's still elements of that at times because nature's, you know, the wild's difficult at times. Sometimes you do have to fight a little bit. But more and more, it's like, wow, this is also amazing. You know, the nature I see around the world, you know, from deserts, mountains, jungles, it's mind blowing. Mm. You know, more and more I see it because I'm not so rushed. So I think when we had young children, like work was like, get in, fight, get home, a million miles an hour. And the kind of, for many years, if I'm honest, the enjoyment went out of it because it was always like, I knew I'd do my job, but the kind of the moments of like, just, I really felt that still whisper over the last 5 years of like, you don't need to live like that, actually. You know, your job's a privilege. Mm. You're with great people that you've fought hard to have alongside you. Just go and enjoy it and hear my voice in those moments because it's in nature and that's where it all begins. Yeah.
If I'd met you age 10 and said, what do you want to do when you grow up, what would you have said?
If you could have said at that age, my job would be essentially still climbing stuff, falling off stuff, getting muddy, getting cold, working hard with great friends. You know, it's what I loved in the military. You know, essentially there was that. But to be able to take the best of that without the, you know, without the sort of the bullets, take the best of that, which was outdoor adventure and with true sort of friends alongside you. That's what I've managed to sort of carve into my career. And I would go, way to go. I would also say to that 10-year-old, don't worry about the failures along the way, of which you'll have many. And it's not always going to be an utter conviction of like you're in the right place. It's like life is full of doubt. Okay, don't worry about that part. Roll with it, but just keep your eye on the good stuff, which has always been family, outdoors, the adventure, and the almighty.
And what did being in the SAS teach you?
The value of great friends, number one. Skills, obviously, that have carried me through so much of life. You know, I mean, my job there was combat survival, and that's become sort of the bedrock of my career. You know, the climbing and the skydiving were special skills of mine there. You know, so obviously the skills were a big part of it. But really, beyond that, it's the friendships that last this day. And also, I think, a belief that I can look after myself when the chips are down. That was a big thing at a young age. You know, it's like, give a dog a good name, they'll live up to it. You know, it's like, now you're in. It's like, come on, you got it. And like, when the chips are down, like, I'm surrounded by the best. You elevate, you become that. Mm. And I love that sort of ethos of like, when it's grim and everyone else is throwing in the towel and they can't go on, this is when we step up. That was a culture there, and I love that. I've tried to hold on to that through so many things since, but I think that was really what it gave me. It's quite confidence at a young age that I maybe didn't have before then.
And it was during that time, a very young age, that you had this accident which could have quite easily been fatal, really, couldn't it?
I was really lucky with that. I mean, people say, you know, say it was unlucky to break your back in three places, but that could have been way worse. You know, it was a jump in Africa, had an issue with the chute, ended up spiraling down very, very fast.
This is the parachute failing to open?
Well, it split. It kind of ripped on opening, and I thought I could control it, but it got faster and faster, and then I should have deployed and used that reserve, but I didn't. Then didn't have time, smashed into the desert, broke my back in three places. Had a long, you know, journey back to the UK, many months in and out of military rehabilitation in the UK. Had an incredible treatment, actually, and support and help. But it was a dark time, you know. It's like, hold on, I can't even reach a bathroom here without real pain. I'm, you know, there's no way I can get back doing the job I was doing. You know, what am I going to do with my life? And I think it was that was harder than just a physical pain that was sort of just a constant thing for, you know, for many, many months after that of the recovery. It was actually the mental side of like, I'm not going to be able to do the level of intensity of job again. What am I going to do? And you sort of start small, don't you? You cling on to simple things. You know, my faith was a key part of that. My family were a key part of that. And having a goal was a key part of it. And that's why Everest became a huge focus for me. It was like, you know, this is what I did when I was a kid, when my dad would climb on these little sea cliffs. It was my job through the military. This is, I'm going to get not just strong enough to reach a bathroom and then on this floor above and the floor above of this rehab center. I'm going to get one day, I'm going to just focus, I'm going to get strong enough to attempt the biggest mountain on earth. And that became, at 22, that became the whole focus of my recovery. That's what I'm going to, win or lose, I'm going to one day, God willing, attempt that climb.
And you did. Only 18 months after the accident, you were one of the youngest to be on Everest.
Yeah, I mean, I look back on that time again with sort of, you know, it was such an informative time. It changed so much, really. You know, it's, I mean, the mountain claimed 4 climbers' lives whilst we were up there. 2 died of the cold, 2 fell. You know, still claiming 1 in 6 people's lives of those who reached the top at that stage. You know, but 2 of us from our team, we had a small military team, 4 of us, 2 reached the top. And I know it changed my life in so many ways. You know, I think, you know, after that, I got back. It was then someone at Discovery Channel. I wrote a book on what happened up there. Somebody at Discovery Channel read that. They approached me. They said, would you ever do a show for us in America where we drop you in difficult places? And, you know, and by this stage, I'd just leaving the military, just got married, young, 24, 25, getting married. Shara's father died in our first year of marriage, and my dad died 10 weeks later. It was like all happened. It was like shock of capture of life at 25. And it was like suddenly now I'm out of that military system. I haven't got a job as such. You know, I'm married. I'm responsible now for two of the mother-in-laws. You know, I'm trying to figure things out. And I know I look back again. You know, I think that was a gift from beyond. I think my dad definitely from beyond helped crack open that door and give me that opportunity. But at the time, I didn't recognize it. I actually said no to that producer 3 times because it was just confidence. I didn't know TV. I wasn't a TV guy. I kept saying, that's not my thing. I can't do that. And he kept saying, well, that's exactly, that's what we want. It just doesn't matter. You know, you can
I think people would be surprised to learn this about you, that you're not naturally someone who wants to be in front of it. Because when people watch you on TV, it looks fantastic. You think, well, this must be...
Well, it's because they edit around it.
So you
well,
don't,
it's true, you know. They put, you know, so the not, TV show makes the good stuff.
You're not as confident as you appear, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, definitely in terms of TV. And it's been a love-hate relationship, really, all my career. You know, I love the adventure and I love the people we work with, a small team, and we've had that same crew from the beginning. Literally from show one. And that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. The hate part is that I really struggle being on camera. You know, whatever I'm doing, whether I'm doing this sort of stuff, whether I'm doing a photo with your nice lady Ruth before show, I'd like, get it done, out of there. And it's like, I don't like it. I struggle with that. But I've learned how to do it. And it's my job. So therefore, I kind of just, when we're filming, I just forget about it. The crew know. They never put a camera on. They never put a red light on me. You got red lights here. You know, I never see that when we're filming. So they just cover it up with black gaffer tape, hold the camera low, and I go, should we do it?
Yeah.
And I go, let's do it. We're heading that way. And off we go. You know,
you don't have to do any of this TV stuff. So if it's such a challenge, why do it at all?
I know. Kind of sometimes I feel that. Sometimes it's like...
Not that I'm trying to encourage you not to, but I'm going to be in trouble. I'm going to be in trouble if I talk you into not doing any more TV. The fans are going to be very upset. But you know what I mean?
I think the changer was for us about 5 years ago, we started our own production company that we then sold sort of at the right time. We just got really lucky with that whole process. And I think what that gave us through it was control to be able to film the shows we want, when we want, with the people we want on our terms. So no longer was it like any pressure to do stuff. And I think that pressure was another part that really mounted in the early years of like, we've got to go bigger and worse and harder and like longer. And it's like the fun went out of it for me. And now, you know, now we do it on our terms. And all of the team, you know, they love that spirit as well. We get in, we work hard and work fast. But now we don't rush so much. We maybe take a day out, chill out at the end, and then we'll come home. And it's like, you know, we film the shows we want. There's no pressure to do stuff that's not good. We just do things we really believe in. I make sure I'm around for school half terms and nativity plays or whatever it is, a important part of being a parent. You know, I've having that luxury now. I've earned the right to be able to have that luxury to say, we'll do it then or not at all. And we'll do it with that guy and we'll shorten that shoot. And that one's kind of fun. We'll take a bit longer there. And we don't need to go three quarters of the way around the world. Let's do this one here. And then the fun goes back into it.
Right.
And because I don't realize then we're filming, that bit's kind of dropped away, even though kind of it's there, kind of drops away. And I think it's good to work. And so God, we keep going for now.
I want to understand more of this mentality of you having this terrible accident, back being broken in three places, and 18 months later being able to climb Everest. And I guess my question is, how much of that is because it's you, the person you are, the person you were created to be? How much of that is just, well, with enough hard work, anyone could have done that?
I think that's probably right, you know, and an element of luck as well. You know, I don't think, I mean, first of all, I'm really not exceptional in any way or in any, you know, I've learned a few skills over my life, but anyone can learn skills, you know, they're not rocket science, you know. I was never the brainiest or the sportiest or anything like that. I was not the superstar in any way at school, you know, so I'm not an exceptional person like that. But I know there is power in life to having a goal, having a clear focus, being willing to put up with a bit of kind of, you know, life hitting you around a bit en route. I know that the key to everything is having a never give up attitude and getting back on your feet and still smiling when it's raining and keep moving forward. And I think if you realise that's a magic key to life. Doesn't mean you're always going to win. But you keep going long enough, you go through enough failures, it'll eventually get there. And so I've always lent on that. You know, I really have. All the way, even through SAS selection, I failed that the first time. And then I realised, hold on, you just got to just give more. Just work harder. Do go the extra mile on everything. And I went back and passed it second time round. And It was the same on Everest, it was the same on many expeditions, it's the same through those early years of TV when I wasn't particularly enjoying it. But like, sometimes you've got to go through those to get to the good stuff. You know, all the good stuff in life is on the other side of doubt, struggle, fear, pain, discomfort. You know, you've got to push through that stuff. So I've learned that that's the key, is not having some amazing sort of natural talent that many people feel they don't have, myself included, growing up.
How much of your work is trying to help people build that resilience? Because some people would say we're in a bit of a mental health epidemic, which is, you know, is complicated, and I don't want to paint in too broad a brushstrokes here, but part of it is certainly people feeling like some people just really struggle to have that mental resilience, to have that belief, to fight on and to push. Yeah. Some people really find that hard. How much of your work is trying to encourage people in that position?
Well, it's more than trying to encourage people, it's trying to tell people the tools to it. And you know, the thing is, it is hard, you know, and it's struggle. It's like going to the gym is hard, you know, but it's the hard stuff that builds the physical strength. You know, you do the chest press, feels hard, but your muscle gets stronger. Same with life, you know. Yes, it's hard, but like understanding that and like going, this is good. I look at hard times now, it's super clear in my brain. It's like hard times are training times. You know, it's just like the gym. It's like training. This is training. And all of us need more resilience in life. You know, there is an epidemic of anxiety with young people around the world at the moment. But being able to deal with difficult situations is not a God-given talent. It's not like, oh, he's good at cricket. He's good at dealing with hard times. It's not like that. Dealing with hard times is a muscle that has to be built, just like that bicep in the gym. You know, you've got to build it. How do you build it? You keep facing it. You don't run from it. You don't avoid it. You do difficult things. You do new things. You do the awkward, the uncomfortable. You know, just in little things every day. And that builds our resilience. And I like that because it's not like something only some people can have. It's like universal. I can help you be resilient. Just go, we'll start off by cranking the shower down to cold for 30 seconds in the morning. The little things, you know, it's like, whatever it is, this is how we build mental resilience. I'm going to have the courage to say to my friend, today I've been struggling recently. You know, that takes courage to walk side by side with someone, to be honest. You know, that is difficult. But you only get the connection when you go through the difficult thing. You can't have a great friendship just given to you. You know, you've got to reach out in vulnerability and be then the friend to them as well and do these difficult things, and then you create something good. And it's the same across all the board. So resilience is something we can all build, but there's no shortcut like the wild. There's no shortcut to the summit of these mountains, no shortcut to getting out of a jungle. You're going to have to face being bitten by some mosquitoes, and you're going to face a few steep ice faces. You got to muscle up and kind of muscle through and keep going step by step. That's why it comes back to the NGU, never give up one. It's why it's a key to it all.
Yeah. I love that example of the shower going to cold in the morning, because obviously for a lot of people, climbing Everest doesn't feel attainable, but they want to build resilience. And that's a really practical example of how you can build a bit of mental strength.
Discipline. It's everything. It's like being outside, you know, maybe walking the last few tube stops instead of taking the tube, you know, on your way to work. Maybe it's getting up a little bit earlier to take the dog out for a proper walk. You know, maybe it's discipline of actually eating natural food rather than just kind of the cheap, easy, you know, rubbish stuff. You know, everything has a sort of a cost, doesn't it? It's doing the difficult when the easy and the lazy is so much more convenient. It's easier to lie in bed longer, you know? It's easier to have the warm shower. It's easier to sit on the tube for the other stops. You know, none of these things are rocket science, but it's just choosing little difficult things. And the thing is, you do that long enough, it becomes a habit. It becomes a DNA. I mean, for me, it's total DNA. It's like in there now.
Bible sales are up. Alpha attendance is up. Young people's interest in God is, you guessed it, up. It's been called a quiet revival, but is it really true? This month, we're bringing you expert analysis and stories galore of God on the move. Enjoy a year's worth of Premier Christianity magazine, including this landmark revival special edition and full digital access, all for just £30. Visit premierchristianity.com.
Yeah, and I love that analogy of the muscle as well, because people have said that about prayer. Like, just show up, you know, don't have to pray all the right words or have an impressive prayer. Just show up every day, and like a muscle, the more you do it,
it's discipline. Discipline is such a sort of, you know, people run away from it, but it actually, you know, you look at Stoicism, the old Stoics, it's like, you know, discipline is the key to everything. And I know it's kind of like, we all like, yeah, that's a scary word, but it really is. I mean, I don't go to church very much, but my kind of church has become, you know, I actually do go a bit more now, and I really enjoy to kind of seek out a few really good ones. But my church has been a daily thing with one of my best, oldest friends. We read through the Bible basically every year, and we do a little chapter every day. We do it every day. We've done it for like a decade now, probably more than that. And it's like sometimes a real shag. It's like, you know, I'm so busy. I've got to get up already at 5 o'clock this morning. I just haven't got to, you know, but it's like he keeps me accountable. If I miss a day, he's going, just checking in, brother, everything all right? And see, we missed yesterday. So I know, I'm sorry. You know, it's so good, you know, but it's not easy. But it's like things are so much easier together as well. Having that buddy to do it with, a buddy to train with, a buddy to have a quiet time with, and a daily reading with, a buddy to, you know, all of these things. Mm-hmm. And it's why also creating our circle of social stuff is so important, because you become like the sort of five people you hang out with the most, and therefore be super careful picking those people.
Yeah. So earlier you mentioned that as a young boy you had that connection with God, and then when you sort of turned up in chapel you thought, oh no, I've got it all wrong, and you mentioned some of the robes and some of the formality of it was quite off-putting for you in terms of church. But then you just said actually more recently you do go to church a little bit. So just help me understand that journey help me understand the untangling of church as opposed to God, because God and church are two different things, right? So what's been the journey with church?
Well, remember, aged eight, when I was confronted with that, it was like I didn't know anything. All I knew is that this is what is being... people are telling me this is what Christianity is. Mm. I don't really like it, to be honest. Mm. I don't really like the people who call themselves Christians either. Most of them are the ones telling me not to smoke, you know, behind the bike shed. Most of the you know, it's like I didn't really like it. You know, I wanted to be free, and I wanted to kind of, I loved the outdoors, and it's kind of like, I just thought, like I said, I thought I got it wrong. And the reason it's been untangling is to realize actually the baby is beautiful. It's the bathwater that's a mess. You know, the bathwater of church is, you know, you have to open a newspaper, church is closing, somebody's, you know, been done for abuse. You know, the bathwater is like horrific. But like the challenge for all of us is to see beyond that and actually lift the baby out of the bath when the baby is beautiful. The baby is like, is Christ, you know, which is freedom and love and never judges and is not confined to that building with the arrow, you know, it's like total freedom. And some churches get that, you know, many churches get that, you know, and it's amazing seeing so many churches coming to life now, and so many more people, young people seeking out great churches. You know, for me, a great church has always been a hospital rather than a theatre. You know, my experience often was a theatre. It was either we're in Latin or it's a theatre of look how great we are. And we all speak in this nice voice and we're all very smiley and nice and it's all quite... So I didn't really believe it. Theatre, you know, the music or whatever. And actually church was... I don't believe the church is ever meant to be that. Church is a community of people that really need each other and help each other and know our need of forgiveness and know that together we're stronger and let's hold her and look up and be empowered and keep it simple and keep it short and, you know, sort of maybe a beautiful bit of scripture and a song if you want it and kind of a cup of tea and a chat. And I don't know, it's like... And when you come across it, it's really beautiful.
Mm. When church gets it right, it's beautiful, and where it goes wrong, it is horrific.
But you know, my real experience of church actually now, like I say, with Jim, my friend, my daily thing, but also like with my boys, our boys growing up, just saying little prayers, kneeling beside their bed like my grandpa used to do. I've done that always with them. You know, and now they're older. It's a sort of family joke of like, you know, I drag them in for prayers, you know, before bed. And they're, oh, no, I want to go to bed. Like, you know, it's a joke. It's fun. Right. It's kind of like, but that's church, you know, and thank goodness for that.
Yeah. I imagine as well in your position, you know, it may not be as simple as just going to a local church because you're there for God and people are supposed to be there for God, but I imagine it might be difficult if actually you are a well-known person and maybe people want a selfie or want an autograph. Is that a challenge for someone?
I find that tricky in the, you know, I love that verse of like David, King David used to worship at the back dressed in his ephod, which was like translated as like a loincloth, and he was king. I kind of always like that, you know. I kind of don't like the thing. I'd hate to be sort of pushed to the front, to the front. You know, it's why I tend to sneak in places, and I like being at the back. But I suppose that has been a challenge with it. But that's not an excuse. You can get around that. I kind of don't flatter myself that. It's not so much that. It's like it's just finding good communities, isn't it, of like-minded people. And there's more and more of it now, and it's beautiful to see. And like actually going to Spring Harvest the other day. Mm. You know, I don't do much of that. And that was just, I actually found it really emotional. I mean, at the end, they wanted to pray, you know, all of them prayed. And like I said, oh, I can't be on stage for this. I've got to get off. It's like, I don't want to be on the stage for, you know. So I came down and everyone put their hands on me. And it was like, you know, I never get that. It's like, I really kind of like, definitely there was a lot of emotion there. And it's beautiful. That's church. That's right there. And I was so grateful for that prayer community. And, you know, that's why I feel excited for this book because, you know, this is like our book. It's not my book. It's like, this is all of our book. This is what I want to give to my friend who doesn't know what faith is because it's so readable and it's so short and it's so accurate and it's exciting. And, you know, that's why I finished the same way I started. Like it's the thing I'm most excited about in my work world, because it's our book. It's like, this is how to share a message of love in a way that is the opposite of what my experience of church as that 8-year-old was.
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned, you know, being a high profile person might come with its challenges. I imagine one of those might be bad press or criticism. Have you found ways to cope with that over time? Have you had to sort of learn how to navigate some of that?
Yeah, definitely over time. You know, it's like, it's just part of it. If you don't want to,
it can't be easy though, like emotionally.
No,
it must be.
No, I think, and I actually don't think it gets any easier. It's not one of these people who's like, oh, that's now I've learned how to deal with it. I've learned how to see it, and I see it now. It's like, you cannot, if you don't want to get criticism, do nothing, but you become nothing, you know. So you just got to realize whoever you are, if you're going to be engaged in the world and you're going to be putting what you hope is positive good things out there, you will get criticism. It is, in fact, if you're not getting criticism, you're doing something wrong. So I see it like that, and I understand that, but my heart still really struggles with it.
Sure.
But you know what? I kind of, that's life. You know, again, it's like, life is okay to struggle. It's okay to find things hard. I'm not one of these people like broad shoulders. Oh, I take no notice of that. I do. I find it hard. It's like, find it hard, you know? But that's okay. Mm. Hard is okay. Just check yourself. Make sure you're doing as best you can. Course correct where needed. Acknowledge mistakes, things you've got wrong, which of which, by the way, there have been many. And then,
really?
And well, then keep
what
going.
Comes, you know? What comes to mind?
I'm not giving you that list. We'll be here all day, you know. But you know, there's just many. It's like life, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. No one's perfect for sure.
Yeah.
Let me bring you back to one of the highlights, though, at least from my perspective, and that was when I can't remember if I read it in a newspaper or loaded up Twitter, and it's like, wow, Bear Grylls is praying with Barack Obama, the sitting president of the US. I mean, how did an opportunity like that come about? Was that a planned thing? Was that just natural, spontaneous? Mm. How do you end up praying with the sitting president of the United
yeah,
States?
Yeah, that was a kind of cool life moment. And I don't know, we'd done this, you know, we did an episode of Running Wild together. They'd reached out to us. They said the president's going to Alaska. He was president at the time, you know, and said, yeah, he's a fan of the show. He wants to see some of the effects of climate change on the glacial stuff. Would you do a mini adventure? And would, you know, so we did this thing, and it was like high octane. It was like a million miles an hour. And we had all the Secret Service in the middle of the mountains and like helicopters all the time and snipers along the route. And, you know, it was like high pressure. I was super nervous beforehand. But actually, then we did it, and it was great. And he was like really humble and normal, and we were talking about just kind of life. And we finished filming, and he said, you know what, Bear? He goes, this has been one of the best days of my presidency. I go, oh, you're kidding. Yeah, because also you kind of know someone at that stage. I go, really? And he goes, yeah, because I'm out of a suit. I'm out of the office. I'm not being grilled on geopolitics around the world and what I've done wrong. We're talking about life and my family and like hopes and aspirations and like, you know, there's space to breathe a little bit, you know. And I thought that was sweet. And we kind of, you know, the camera were doing what they now do so well by default, which is kind of they'd finished and they backed off. Most of them are sorting things out. We always leave just one running because often those long lens conversations at the end are the real stuff. I didn't even know they were doing this. But I kind of felt like here's a guy who's got the weight of his world on his shoulders as well. Just this little day together has been special for him. He doesn't get much of this. And I don't know, I just spontaneously said, before we go, I should pray for you. And just prayed for, like, you know, strength and wisdom and help and good judgment and, you know, all of it. Just quick. And they put it, and I forgot about it, and it kind of went in the edit. And then NBC were a bit funny about it. We saw it. I thought, that's really nice. And they said, oh, I'm not sure about that. I see, just leave it in. And got them to leave it in. They did. And actually, it's had a beautiful effect. I mean, you know, even when we filmed with Prime Minister Modi of India, at the end of our journey together, he said he wanted to pray. And he said, I saw you praying with Obama. We should pray. And he had already. He now prayed. And it was beautiful. And it was like, I don't know, that was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a lovely example of you very naturally being able to share your faith. I mean, we've talked a lot about courage and resilience and fear, and a lot of Christians are quite afraid of sharing their faith.
And me too, you know, I really am. I find it awkward and difficult. But if you've listened this far, you will know the answer. You know, the difficult is the right place to be. You know, do the difficult and we build our strength. So I've learned that, like, I don't shy away from that's fine. If you want to know, I'll tell you what helps me in life, you know. I won't sugarcoat it. I won't say it's all perfect and it's like there's no doubts ever. There are. There's struggle and many doubts. But that's okay. This is what's helped me. And I don't mind sharing with whether it's Obama and however many millions of people watching that this is a quiet part of my life that helps me in the wild and in everyday life. So try to live like that. But yeah, I like that thing of doubt and faith, two sides of the same coin. You actually can't have faith without doubt.
And what are the doubts?
Well, the doubts is the whole thing crazy. You know, is it actually real? I mean, what's the point of dedicating your life to something if it's not real? Mm. You know, and you know the cool thing I read yesterday is that even John the Baptist, who was like a huge hero of mine, you know, the closest of like, you know, brothers, you know, first cousin to Jesus, you know, and when they were pregnant, their mums were pregnant, the babies kicking whenever Jesus pregnant and Mary came near, you know, they were the tightest of tight. He knew from the beginning who Jesus was. He spent his whole life was just dedicated, like, I'm paving the way. There's one coming who's greater. I'm not even worthy to untie. Look at this guy. He's come. Here he comes. And then he eventually, you know, comes and baptizes him and all this journey. And yet, when John is eventually imprisoned, the message he sends his disciples to go and ask Jesus are you really it? It's like, you know, he said, my job has become less and his become more. And he's in prison and and yet here is a guy who truly knows. He grew up with Jesus. He knows. But yet there's doubt. And it's like, that's beautiful, you know, because if you can doubt, it's like even in the book, you know, Thomas is always known as Doubting Thomas, isn't he? You know, but it's like actually his faith must have been incredible. You know, we're all doubters. We're all doubters. John the Baptist, you know, they don't call John the Baptist John the Doubter. You know, but he could have been. All of us could be. So I find that reassuring, the moments of doubt for me when I'm going, really? Yeah. Really? Could that actually be true? And that's why I really get encouragement from, like, really intelligent people that study it. It's why this process of the Grace Story has been beautiful as well for me. It's like, I've sat across with so many brains that are so incredible, like off the scale, you know, double first, a sort of Oxford Cambridge, study it all their life, just obsessed by sort of every day, you know. And in a court of law, they would say he rose again. He rose again. Look at the evidence. The evidence is, you know, but there will always be that element of step of faith and doubt. And I find it really reassuring when people who have really good brains, much better than mine, go, Bear, it's good. And I said it to Andrew at Spring Harvest the other day. I said, Andrew, a part of me thinks I'm going mad. You know? Really? I really struggle sometimes. And he just put his arm around me and goes, that's it. That's the calling. That's like you've been prepared for a time like this to step into it with the doubts, but step into it.
Yeah.
And that's great.
I speak to a lot of Christians who have very similar stories around kind of being told the faith has to look exactly like this and then having those doubts. And in time, just understanding, actually, it's all right. We all have them. It's okay to doubt. It doesn't need to be this
big. People don't talk about that a lot. And like vicars, it's always like, I don't know, the danger of church is making it all too great and all too kind of like shiny.
All too easy, yeah.
Shiny and like together. And I've got the answers because I'm the vicar. And it's like, I suppose it's so important in positions of leadership, especially for vicars, to like just be honest, like struggle. Like because everyone you're speaking to struggles with stuff. They probably, most of them have, you know, addictions to X, Y, and Z. You know, it's like, just share it. We're all in the same boat. We're all saying on our knees, looking up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wanted to bring it back to the book as we finish. And one of the things that really struck me in the reading of it is, for us as Christians who we try and we read our Bibles, we hear scripture being read, we can so easily, I think, become overly familiar with it if we've been reading the Bible for a long time. And one of the lovely things about your book is it sort of shakes you out of that, because you're reading this language in a new way. Yeah. And I just wondered if that was your experience as well in imagining these scenes, and how much you think this book might help Christians to remember, as you said, this is a real thing that really happened in a real place.
Yeah. Well, you know, like my best buddy, who's kind of like, you know, regular guy, beautiful guy, you know, he read it the other day, and he's not sort of person who would normally kind of, you know, read a book like this. And he goes, the thing that stands out to me is just the humanness of Yeshua being Jesus in the book, that he's the Son of God, but also living and feeling like a normal person. And also the fallibilities of the disciples. Honestly, Bear, I found this book more moving than anything I've experienced for a long time, especially their doubts. It makes it so real, where so many depictions that we hear from the Bible are abstract and unrelatable. Mm. You know, and that's the sort of, you know, that's my hope for the book. You know, because as I say, if John the Baptist had doubts, sure as hell the disciples had doubts to the end. to the end, even at the Last Supper when he's saying, this is what's going to happen. You know, I'm going to be tortured tomorrow and killed for you. It's like, no, hold on. I've seen you walk on water and no, just no, that's not a good idea. You know, it's like, hold on, just step away. And it's like, I don't know, it's very fresh and visceral. It's quite hardcore at the end, I warn you. It gets quite intense. It starts off very innocent, like I say, with Mary, but it gets really pretty intense. It's not an easy read by the end. Like the chairman of this drinks company, the guy, I'm thinking, wow, you're feeling this. You're only on page, you know, you're only through the Mary and through the Peter bit, and like you're going to be in trouble by the end. So it does get quite hardcore, but it was hardcore. Yeah. You know, there you go. It's like Christianity is tough. It's like, you know, it's, and Jesus was tough. I think we sometimes get this idea of him being like all smiley and white and nice, and like he was hardcore. You know, he was like we're doing this. And like to walk into that is like he was hardcore.
Yeah. and Jesus being a man and the humanity of Christ is interesting. I mean, you'll be aware there's so much in the press and the media around kind of what is masculinity. Someone said to me the other day that the only time you hear people talk about masculinity is when the word toxic is in front of it. And that might be a bit of an exaggeration, but you know, you get the point of there is this, you know, what does it mean to be a man? And you know, I think more than that, this desire for, we need some more good male role models. Yeah. As opposed to some of the people are following. I mean, are you concerned about that as well?
Well, it's important. It's okay to be strong. You know, it's part of our calling in life, all of us, to live strong, empowered, effective lives. I don't think it's about gender. You know, it's like, how do you live a great life? Yeah, you've got to be determined. Yeah, you've got to be tough. Yeah, you've got to have a kind of streak of steel. But yes, you've also got to be respectful and kind and gentle and sensitive. You know, so I don't think that's a gender-specific thing. It's like, how do you want to live your life, you know? That's how, you know, you can only speak for yourself, but that's how I want to live my life. And faith is part of that arsenal, you know? It's like that quote, man is never as strong or never as tall as when he kneels down. I like that. You know, there's a kind of humility as a strength, vulnerability as a strength. You know, I know, all of this.
And that's Jesus. Humility is a strength, vulnerability is a strength. That's what he models.
Totally, and that's a great model. You know, I mean, if you want really the model of how to, you know, be a true man or true woman, you know, maybe the phrases are flawed. You know, it's how to be a great human being. You're not going to get a better example in terms of, as you say, sort of strength and humility and love. And love has to be in there. Mm-hmm. You know, whoever you are, however strong a person you want to be, you know, if you really want to be, you know, you love has to be there. Mm-hmm. And love isn't weak, you know. It's like we are called to be, all of us, called to be warriors. Doesn't mean you always have to use it, but you've got to have that strength. And where are you going to draw that strength from? And if you're only going to draw it from yourself, I'm telling you, you're not going to be that strong.
Yeah.
And that's a beating heart of faith for me, is like, I want to live a strong life, and therefore I want to plug into the source. Mm. You know, I'm not strong as a glove just on my own, but when the hand goes in the glove, I'm strong. Mm. You know, I'm not strong as a sort of a, you know, toaster's not very effective if it's not plugged in. You know, but plug it in, it gets kind of red hot and it kind of can do, you know, has the capacity to burn. You know, but use that strength wisely. You know, all of this sort of stuff is, I suppose, speaking to that thing. And I get it, a lot of people talk about toxic masculinity, but I think both words miss the point, really.
Mm. At the very end of the book, you write, on the final page, may the light and love of the Almighty fill your life with truth, peace and strength. Nothing can ever steal Christ's presence from you.
Mm.
What made you want to finish the book with that prayer?
I don't know. These are the bits that I found really exciting and beautiful and easy to write. You know, it's a garnish on top of the, you know, it's the icing on top of the cake. It's the little sprinkles. It's the important stuff, you know, those bits I knew from the beginning. I wrote that before I started the book. I knew how I wanted to finish it. I even put it actually on the inside flap as well, which is kind of nice, you know, and it's got this half cover, you know, the light and love of the Almighty fill your life. And then the other bit, actually the last line added of everything was, was on the sort of bit at the end where I do the author's note of explaining the translations and how we haven't changed anything and, you know, how the words, how the names and everything come about. But I say at the end, please join us in praying that this book will bring many millions to know for themselves the truth that sets us free. Mm. And actually, that was the last sentence I wrote of everything, because that's the kind of heart of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think it's been interesting. People love this bit, what happened to the disciples at the end. Because you've read such an intense journey with these guys who are so human, so flawed. And then suddenly we use their real names, you recognise them, and here we go. This, and all of them, you know, skinned alive, stabbed, crucified upside down, you know, stoned to death. I mean, I guess, you know, it's pretty full on. But like I say, proudest thing I've done.
And, you know, you didn't have to do a book about Jesus. You didn't have to speak to a Christian magazine. You didn't have to go to Spring Harvest. How much of this is a bit of a new thing for you, of just, you know what, is this a bit of a new calling for you in terms of the faith stuff? You don't have to talk about faith. You could carry on doing all the TV shows, but you're choosing to. How much of that is sort of a deliberate decision from you?
Well, it wasn't a conscious decision, but I could just, as you say, just do that. But then I'm starting to live out of an authentic kind of what I really feel. You know, the truth is, I've just tried to follow my heart with this stuff. It's like I didn't have to write the book, but I did. I couldn't have not written. Like you speak to Jesse when I was writing it. There's nothing. Wild horses couldn't have stopped me. You know, and also the fact I literally woke up one morning and knew I was going to write this thing, like with utter conviction. It wasn't even a question of like, I got straight on the phone to the publishers. I spoke to Andy Lyon, head of Hodder. I said, we're going to do this. It's going to be the biggest selling book in history. He kind of laughed. I said, it will. It will. We're going to have the Bible, the Quran, but after those, it's going to be the bigger. You watch, it's going to be. And nobody's ever told the story of Jesus as a straight linear story, dramatized, exciting, short, punchy, accurate, but only using the words of Jesus' dialogue, not changing any of that. And he goes, actually, it's so weird. There'd be millions and millions of books written, and Christian books written, but nobody's ever done this before. And it's like, so I felt I didn't have a choice. It's like it was never in doubt. It was like if somebody said, but this might ruin your entire career, be the end of your career, I would still do it. It's like I knew. And it's like I know the things that I'm meant to be doing now. You know, like I knew I was going to speak at that Spring Harvest. I knew there are a few key podcasts I'm going to do about this book and then not do more. And it's just like I'm just trying to follow the heart. And it's like, that's when Andrew puts his arm around me and said, he's like, for a time like this, you feel the fear and the doubts, but just walk into it. And it's like, it's meant to be. But the other final thing is I can't do this on my own. You know, we're all small cogs in the wheel. You know, it's like you have played a part in this. Andrew's played a part in it. All these people have played a part in it. You know, Andy Lyon at Hodder believing in it, you know, having that vision of like, that's a big vision. It's like, you know, and we all need, I can't do this on our own. It's working because people are going, I'm buying 100 copies. Somebody just texted me to say, I bought 500 copies. I used some of my savings to buy 500 copies so every child at my child's school gets a copy. You know, that is the power of this. So it's going to be our book. It really is going to be all of our book to share with people. And it's like, if you want to read the accurate, incredible and exciting thriller story of Jesus, boom, here we go.
Here we go. Bear Grylls, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good fun, Sam. Well done. And well done with the magazine. You're smashing it. I'm subscribing. Come on.
Come on. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.